Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Most failures happen not because people don't work hard, not because they're not passionate, not because they don't execute well, but because they're building the wrong product. As I say in the book, make sure you're building the right it before you build it. Yeah. Right. A lot of failures cannot be attributed to incompetence or lack of desire. Just people pick the wrong idea. And I saw that in my father and in my experience as an entrepreneur, I kept seeing that many, many times. In fact, I would say that 80% of engineers and product managers, whatever titles you have in most companies, are working with products that when launched will fail. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't like that, Srini, because our most valuable resource, right, to solve all the problems in the world are entrepreneurs and innovators, inventors, right? Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are going to come up with a new solution. And yet you take this most valuable resource and 80% of the time they're going to fail. So that really doesn't sit well with me. And that's why I wrote the book. And, you know, the book is just the outcome of 10 years of research and making sure that what I teach and what I discuss actually works. So that's my mission, to beat failure.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Alberto, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me, Srini. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I, as we were saying before we hit record here, I came across your book, The Right It, Why So Many Ideas Fail and How to Make Sure You Succeed. And the title grabbed me immediately because I'd seen so many failures in my own life with a lot of my own online projects. But then, you know, I dug into it. And as somebody who likes everything to be backed by research and data, it really, really struck a chord with me. So I emailed you right away. And, you know, we're finally doing this. But before we get into the content of the book, this is something I had wanted to ask you just based on your last name and now obviously based on your accent. Where in the world were you born and raised? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you've made with your life?
Yes. So, I love this personal question. I was born in Rome, Italy. And just like pizza, I came to America to become bigger and better. And I landed in Silicon Valley. Actually, my parents divorced, so I came here with my father, you know, to start a new life. And I landed in Silicon Valley, and I thought, well, I want to be an entrepreneur. You know, it's in the air. And so that's how I came to come up with the experiences that I discuss in the book, how I learn about failure and how to overcome it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of growing up, I think, in every culture is that culture instills certain values, certain belief systems, you know, certain programming. And I wonder what aspects of the Italian culture do you think played a role in you ending up doing what you're doing? And what aspects do you think you actually rejected as to be able to do what you do?
Yeah, great question. So I would say, you know, Romans are pretty famous, you know, both the philosophers and the engineers are very empirical. Right. They were able to build aqueducts that went hundreds of miles without really knowing the physics behind it. So, if you look at like Roman philosophy and Greek philosophy, you know, the Greeks have Plato and the world, they deal with the work of Idea and the allegory of the cave, and they come up with all these theoretical concepts. whereas the Roman philosophers and engineers are much more practical. They tinker, right? They build, they try to learn things firsthand, and I'm a big believer in doing that. So I would say I've taken that actual attitude in my life to just tinker. And I guess the part I've rejected is that in Italy, and I would say in most of Europe, and not just Europe, pretty much anywhere outside Silicon Valley, there is this fear of failure. There's a huge stigma attached with failure, right? There are countries in Europe where if you have a bankruptcy, you're not allowed to start a company for 10 other years. So just like you go into entrepreneurial jail. I'm much more comfortable with failure. Having said that, I do not like to fail, and I think failure can be handled, and that's why I decided to write this book based on my experiences with great successes at Google and some of my startups, but also with one failure that really bit me and hurt me. And I said, okay, you bit me, I'm going to bite back. And the result is the work of my last 10 years.
Okay, so we'll come back to the failure that bit you in Google and all of this. But one other thing I wonder is, in the Italian culture, what do parents teach their kids about risk tolerance, about pursuits that where, you know, the outcome isn't guaranteed? Is it similar to sort of the Indian or Asian culture where, you know, you're constantly encouraged to be doctors, engineers, go do something stable, and then, you know, if you don't do that, they're like, well, then how the hell do you plan to get paid? Or do they encourage, you know, a variety of pursuits?
You know, I would say it's neither. I don't think there is this pressure to be a doctor or a lawyer as in some other culture. But there is this tendency to stick close to your knitting. So if your father was a butcher in Rome, maybe they would like you to be the son of a butcher in Rome. You know, being a butcher, I guess it's a good thing. So they don't want you to take too many risks. But I cannot say that there is, just like there is in some other culture, this generalized uniform push to have your children to be or do anything specific. I've observed that. I have a lot of friends and colleagues, of course, as you can imagine, from India, and I can notice the difference in their culture, how important for them it is to achieve, to succeed, to get the title, where I would say that we're a bit more nonchalant, right? And in fact, you can see it in the result. The Italian economy is not exactly booming. Right. We tend to take things a little bit easier, more relaxed. So Italy is a great place for vacation. Uh-huh. So I hope that by combining my Italian attitude with this kind of Silicon Valley drive, it's a good combination.
It's funny you say that because as you were saying that, I remember, you may have seen it, Michael Moore did a documentary called Where to Invade Next, where he goes around to different countries in Europe to look at various social policies. And he goes to Italy, and he looks at their, you know, 8 weeks of paid vacation policy. He's like, these people look like they're having sex all the time. And, you know, it turns out that was actually true is what they said. But the way that the culture there in terms of work really operates was so different when I saw that documentary. So how old were you when you came here?
I was 17. So I finished high school in the United States, which was quite a shock, right? Because my level of English is, imagine if you studied, I don't know, Spanish or some other language in high school. Uh-huh. I knew as much English as you learn if you take, you know, 2 hours a week in high school through your junior years. But fortunately, I learned, I'm pretty good with languages, human languages and computer languages. So it wasn't a bad transition. Actually, I liked it. You know, when I landed in Silicon Valley, in California, it took me maybe 2 or 3 months. And then I realized, you know, I'm a Silicon Valley boy in a Roman body. For me, it felt very, very natural. I'm still attached to my homeland, but this is the place I was meant to be here.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, particularly when you have transitioned into an environment at that age, you know, when so much of your social programming has been kind of done, like what did you find shocking about the culture by landing in high school here? Like, what did you find different? What did you find strange? Were there any things that made you think, oh, these American people are out of their minds?
Well, so I'll tell you, this has nothing to do with the book, but it's a fun story. So the first week of high school, I made some friends and I said, okay, let's go out. Let's have fun. And we were 17. And it turns out that for them, fun was scoring a 12-pack of beers and going in a parking lot and drinking beer at 17, which, you know, in Italy, they have you sip wine when you're six. Mm-hmm. So I didn't find that much of a thrill. So it took me a while to adjust to these, to the American culture, you know, especially the drinking part that it seems to be such a big deal over here. And, you know, in Italy, we take it for granted.
Yeah. So, you know, this ability to bite back at failures, you know, I wonder, part of me wonders, is this grit something that can be cultivated, or do you get it through experience? Because I feel like often emotional resilience is only the byproduct of going through something painful. Like, you build a tolerance for this painful thing by going through it. And so I wonder, you know, where did this start? But more importantly, like, what led you down this path? Like, where did you go to college? Like, you know, were you set on the idea of computer science and entrepreneurship right out of high school?
Yeah. So no, I'll tell you the background. Actually, you know, I'd never thought about this until I listened to one of your previous podcasts where you asked about somebody's parents and, you know, how they influenced you. And when my father came to the US after my parents' divorce, he always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And he was a smart guy. He was a hardworking guy, but he had a lot of failures. And so, you know, I kept seeing my father fail with this idea and that idea. And I hadn't thought about that until, what, two or three decades later, when I thought, huh, maybe I have this bone to pick with failure, because I saw my dad failing and trying too hard. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of my book is that most failures happen not because people don't work hard, not because they're not passionate, not because they don't execute well, but because they're building the wrong product. As I say in the book, make sure you're building the right it before you build it. Yeah. Right. A lot of failures cannot be attributed to incompetence or lack of desire. It just people pick the wrong idea. And I saw that in my father and in my experience as an entrepreneur, I kept seeing that many, many times. In fact, I would say that 80% of engineers and product managers, whatever titles you have in most companies, are working with products that when launched will fail. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't like that, Trini, because our most valuable resource, right, to solve all the problems in the world are entrepreneurs and innovators, inventors, right? Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are going to come up with a new solution. And yet you take this most valuable resource and 80% of the time they're going to fail. So that really doesn't sit well with me. And that's why I wrote the book. And, you know, the book is just the outcome of 10 years of research and making sure that what I teach and what I discuss actually works. So that's my mission, to beat failure.
Mm. Okay. So I think that the funny thing is, in Silicon Valley, I think we don't have this, you know, failure stigma, but our education system really does stigmatize failure, particularly here in the United States. There's a really beautiful book by a woman named Jessica Leahy, who's a middle school teacher. And I remember picking it up because it was about overcoming failure. And I can tell you, as somebody who grew up in an Indian family, there are two things that happen when it comes to grades. Nobody puts your report cards on fridges when you get A's. That's just the expectation. And if you get a B+, the only question is, why didn't you get an A? And if you get F's, it's just out of, you know, that never happened in my household, because you just didn't want to ever wonder, you know, like what the potential outcome of getting an F is. I remember the day I got sent to the principal's office, and I did it on purpose because I wanted to see how my mom would react. Not well. I knew, I was like, okay, I left a book in a locker, and we had this really stupid check system where if you got six checks in a day, you got sent to the principal's office. And the principal was like, what are you doing here? I was like, I don't know. I just wanted to see what this was like.
Yeah, but I absolutely. Different cultures have different tolerance for not just for failures, right, but for not meeting a certain bar. Mm. And the way we destigmatize failure, to go back to the original question, it just, like, I actually came up with a term, which I teach in my class. I call it failophobia, and failophobia is an irrational fear of failure. So it's such a fear that it keeps you from doing, from taking very reasonable, risks. And the way to cure failophobia is to expose yourself to small failures. Because, one of the things that I tell people is that failure is like cholesterol. There is good failure and bad failure, right? Mm-hmm. So, good failure is, hey, I have an idea. Let's do an experiment. Let's spend, you know, $20 and a couple of hours or a couple of days to see if anybody's interested in this idea. And if it doesn't work, that's good failure, right? Yeah. You fail fast, as I like to say. You fail Ferrari fast and Fiat cheap.
like that.
Because people say, yeah, we fail fast. And I said, how long was your last failure? Well, only 3 months. I said, no. That's slow. You want to fail Ferrari fast and Fiat cheap.
Yeah. So
when you get used to dealing with small failures, just like if you're afraid of spider, first I show you the photo of a spider, right? And then a little spider 10 feet away, and then they move it closer. When you expose yourself to a lot of experiments and you see that things don't work and you're still alive and ready to experiment another day, that's how you overcome a failophobia.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that's in so many ways you're describing the process we used for, you know, building the Architects of Reality conference. Like, we didn't book a venue and then try to sell tickets. We basically put up a landing page and said, all right, if you're interested, sign up. And I knew, I said, okay, if nobody buys tickets on day one, then we've not invested immense amounts of time and money into this thing, which fortunately that isn't what has happened, which is great. But it was a great way to protect the downside. Now, one thing I wonder, having interviewed at Google and not getting the job, I know that you attract, you know, sort of the best of breed people. In my mind, you attract the types of people who've basically been conditioned their entire life to avoid failure because they're people who go to places like Berkeley and Stanford and Harvard. So when they've got this narrative, like, do you find any resistance in their ability to let go of this need to not fail?
Well, no, because for the following reason, because the approach that I teach is so logical. You know, I'm an engineer, you know, mm-hmm. I'm actually kind of a mathematician by background and a programmer. So I, unlike some people that market ideas, I cannot present something to you if it doesn't make logical sense from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. So I'm an engineer and I speak the engineers and the Googlers language. So the people who join Google usually are very logical. They understand things. So when I present the tools and techniques of pretotapping that I describe in the book, I at every step I ask them, is this logical? Does it make sense? And they said, yes, absolutely. So we're able to overcome any resistance. And at the end, I said, yes, dang, this is right. Why didn't anyone teach it to me before? Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't tell them that this works. I tell them this cannot not work. Yeah. It's like the quadratic equation, right? Before somebody came up with it, people were, you know, kind of making wild ass guesses and plotting and, you know, do trial and error. Mm-hmm. Then somebody showed you the quadratic equation. If you plug in the right numbers and do it right, it always works. Yeah. So the tools and things that I teach have to have that property for me. They must always work and they must be very logical. That's why I haven't met any resistance. In fact, very wide acceptance.
Mm. Just out of curiosity, do you have children?
I have two kids, a 30-year-old daughter and a 25-year-old son. Both work at startup.
Okay.
In startups, including my daughter works at Stitch Fix. And here's a family related story. So when she came to me and told me, hey, dad, I really want to join this company. And she explained to me what Stitch Fix does. For those of you who don't know, you know, you subscribe, you have a stylist, and every month you get a box with 5-6 pieces of clothing picked for you by a stylist. You keep the ones that you want and send back the ones you're not interested in. And when she described it to me, I said, honey, you know that that teaches about failure, right? So, you know, this is a startup. Most startups will fail. I don't know about this idea. You know, I'm not a woman or somebody likes to shop for clothing, but just be prepared that it might fail. Fortunately, it turned out to be a huge success. They had an IPO. Yeah. They're worth a couple of $1 billion. Yeah. So I'm glad it worked out for her. And my son is working at a local company here in Mountain View that works on AI and robotics. So, my family is all Silicon Valley as much as it can be.
Yeah, well, because the reason I asked the question is, and I know having heard the podcast, you know, that despite me not having any kids, I seem to always want to ask questions about parenting and kind of what advice you would give to parents who are listening to this about how to encourage this in their kids. Because it seems like, you know, your kids have inherited this ability to do this and to think this way, maybe probably as a byproduct of having you as a father. What advice would you give to parents who are listening if they have kids? Because I think the earlier that you can cultivate this capacity, the more likely you are to end up with better outcomes. Because, you know, when I went to Berkeley, you know, it was so hard to do anything. Even executing an idea, you needed, you know, hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars in technical skills. Now, a lot of that is gone. And I think much more of what we're trying to overcome is sort of this internal battle that we're talking about.
Yeah. So I'm not really the right person to give parental advice because I think a lot of it is luck, right? What worked on our kids may not work on other kids. So I would say we probably had 20% influence in what they did. I think that by seeing me join Sun Microsystems in the early days, doing my first startup that went very well in the when they were kids, and then joining Google, who did very well. And then seeing my second startup, the one that prompted me to write the book that didn't work out as well, they kind of learned that, you know, you can fail with a startup. Some of the time it succeeds and then, you know, it really pays off and it's a great thing. And even if you fail, look, dad's latest startup didn't work, but he went back to Google and now everything seems to work. So yeah, failure, nothing to be too afraid about it. I think that may be the influence I've had on that.
Yeah. So I want to talk briefly about the culture at Google, mainly because this is something I personally wondered about. And I think I've had one other person who worked at Google here, but I think nobody in sort of, you know, the level of sort of seniority that you're in. And the reason this is, you know, just personally morbid curiosity for me is because, as I told you, when I was in business school, I got rejected for a job at Google. And I think one of the things that I remember very distinctly was how difficult some of the interview questions were. I remember going to an investment banking interview and somebody's like, you know, how many golf balls can you fit in a 747? And now my answer would be, well, unless Richard Branson and I are planning on doing ecstasy, I can't see any reason why I would need to know that. So part of me wonders, I know that part of this has changed. What is it that, you know, like makes candidates stand out in your mind? When you guys hire people who come to work for you, what is it that makes somebody successful at a place like Google?
Well, you know, Right now, I'm on leave from Google, and the company has, I don't know what, how many employees, but now it's a huge number. So I really do not know what's going on in all departments, but I would say that your experience is shared by a lot of people. I've personally recommended friends of mine whom I knew to be extremely smart, and somehow, somewhere in the interview process, something did not work. So I would say if you didn't get an offer from Google after one interview, you're in very good company. But here's the thing. If you really want to work there, keep applying, right? Mm. Because, if you're in the ballpark, maybe someday you get somebody that asks you that question that really completely throws you off for a loop, or maybe it's a bad day for you. So I've had friends that first time they did not get the job, but then they replied and they were, accepted in the future.
Well, I want to come back to sort of this, you know, super high level of achievement of people like Larry and Sergey, but let's bring that back to, you know, the later part of the conversation, because I think it'll be more relevant there. Let's actually get into, you know, the content of the book itself. So one of the first things you say is the root cause of most failures can be traced back to muddy, fuzzy, undisciplined thinking. So I guess, you know, how do you get to disciplined thinking? And then what is what you call, you know, market failure? Like, how do you distinguish between market failure and market success?
Yeah. So as I write in the book, remember, I'm an engineer, so I tend to be very precise in my definition. Failure is when your expected results are less than the, when your actual results are less than the expected results, right? So for your conference, you expect to sell, 300 tickets, and you only sell 50 tickets. That would be failure, correct?
Yeah.
Right. And on the other hand, if you say you're expecting to sell 200 tickets and you sell 500, that would be success. So that's how we define it. Okay. So the first step, when you come up with a new idea, is to be very specific about what success means to you. Mm-hmm. And so for a while, for a couple of years, I was trying to get people to express it as clearly as I could. And then one day at Stanford during office hours, I had one of those moments that you remember. In fact, in the book, I took a photo of that moment over the whiteboard, because it was so powerful. So I had this group of students, they had an idea for an portable air quality monitor, and they kept expressing their idea in very fuzzy ways. Yeah, some people that work in very polluted city would buy this device for their kids. And I was struggling to get them to say it with numbers, right? Stop being so fuzzy. And someone had left on the whiteboard some equations from, I think it was probably calculus class, you know, with X, Ys, and Zs. That's when I had this flash of insight. I said, all right, stop. Tell me your idea using this formula. At least X percent of Y will do Z. X percent is a percentage of your target market. Mm-hmm. Y is your target market. And Z is some action with skin in the game, something that they will do.
Yeah.
So that forces you to take a fuzzy idea and put it into a very clear format. So instead of saying, some people in very polluted city will buy a portable air quality device from us, it would say 10% of people living in cities with an air quality index higher than 100 will spend $99 on a portable air quality device. So this is the clarity that you need to have at the beginning to express your idea. Make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I have a question around that. So I don't know if you've ever read it. There's a book called The Four Disciplines of Execution. I don't remember who the authors were, but Cal Newport mentioned this in his book as well, right? So often the numbers we're talking about. So for example, you could say, okay, I'm going to increase the traffic to my website, right? Or I'm going to sell X number of books. Or what you call a lagging indicator, because you don't control that per se. So how do you balance the sort of knowing that, okay, this is what the success number looks like, X number of book sales, with knowing that, okay, wait a minute, like I control my effort in terms of writing a good book, in terms of, you know, reaching out to making podcast appearances, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, whether I can control the metric or not is, you know, questionable. The other thing is, you know, you mentioned the conference, and, you know, I wonder what role time plays in all of this, because, you know, you're right. Like if we wanted to sell 300, which is what we're aiming for, but we have until April. And that's what, so I wonder about that. You know, it's like, you're probably not going to sell all 300 in 1 week.
Well, that is correct. So what you do is, that's why the formula says at least X percent of Y will do Z, right? So, and then what you do, and I describe in the book, is a technique called hypo-zooming, right? So let's speak for your conference. First of all, who is your target audience?
The people who listen to the podcast.
Perfect. You know, it couldn't be any better, right? So how many people do you have listening to the podcast?
On any given week, probably, last I looked at the metrics, anywhere between 30 to 40,000.
Okay, so that's an awesome number, right? So you don't need to do a lot. So, and what do you expect them to do? So ultimately, you would like them to sign up for the conference that, yep. And I know you're doing it in Nashville and it's reasonably priced because you want to try to get as many people as possible,
exactly.
Correct?
We wanted to make it accessible. Because when we did a conference, I think in 2014, because it was small and we didn't have economies of scale, we had to price it extremely high in order to cover it. So that's why we moved it to Nashville, because we thought, you know what, we priced out way too many people last time. The whole purpose of this was community. And I really wanted to make this something that anybody could get to.
Perfect. So here's a perfect XYZ hypothesis for you. Because you have so many listeners, you can have a very small percentage. You could say, 2% of the people who listen to my podcast will submit their email to request an invitation or some more information about the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed?
Yep.
Right. So by setting an at least number, you are not projecting how many will participate, but that at least number is important because that's where the viability of your idea comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So in design thinking, we have three things that must work out for a product, for an idea to succeed. Desirability, do people want your product? Feasibility, can you build and deliver your product? And viability, can you make a business out of it,
mm-hmm.
right? So clearly you can put up a conference, that's feasible, right?
Yep.
You can test desirability using the prototyping techniques. Yep. By the way, that's the area I'm focused on, right? Desirability, mm-hmm. make sure that people want your product.
Yep.
Then it comes to the viability, and that's where it becomes a business. And that's where you decide, look, I need to have at least 0.5% of my monthly audience
mm-hmm.
Sign up for the conference to make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
And that's what determines your lower bound. And then you do experiments to see if you can actually get anywhere near there.
Yeah.
Now, things may explode, right? So people always tell me, well, Alberto, how can I predict, you know, if we're going to be the next Facebook or the next Google? I call it, no, you cannot do that, right? But think of how all of these companies started. Facebook started by inviting Harvard students for dating purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Google started at Stanford indexing all the Stanford online material internally, right? So they all start with a very, very small focus, and then they start to expand more and more. Same thing with Gmail.
Mm-hmm.
Gmail started as an internal project by people that weren't too happy with how other mail services worked. It was used internally. And then after 2 or 3 years of people inside Google really liking it, right? So that's what, you know, clearly desirable. They did a pilot. They invited 1,000 people from outside Google. Almost all of them signed up. So that clearly indicates success. And then after 3 months, they were all still using it regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you an idea of initial level of interest and ongoing level of interest. Now, for Gmail to go from that stage to being, you know, the behemoth that it is now, it takes a lot of great execution, right? And continued pressure and innovation, et cetera, et cetera. So you cannot predict what's going to happen at the end.
Yeah.
But if at the beginning, if you couldn't get, you invite 1,000 people and 3 sign up,
yeah,
then right, you know, it's going to be a slog. So
That's
why I phrase it, at least X percent of my target market will do this, because that sets up your viability.
Okay.
I need to have 0.5% of the people.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
So I have to ask you why, for example, the book publishing industry doesn't work this way. I mean, I know you wrote about it in the book, and it's funny because we just released a free ebook called Make More Art. And I literally, I'm sure some of my thought process was driven by reading your book. I was like, why put it behind we don't need an email address, we don't need anything. Let's just see how many people download it to see if the idea resonates at all. And, you know, before we even bother, and in it, I said, hey, by the way, you know, if you want to pre-order a physical copy of this book, here's a landing page to sign up. So, you know, the stakes are much lower. We get this nice brand building piece. But I'd been thinking about this idea a lot when it comes to publishing. And I started writing a blog post titled Minimum Viable Publishing. But the publishing industry does this like pretty much backwards where, you know, like my joke is basically they hand out, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in advances and Tim Ferriss and Michelle Obama make up for the losses that they take on everybody else. And yet it seems that when you have an audience, why wouldn't you sell the book first, then have the author go and write it, then have the author go into a cave for a year and a half, then put together this aggressive marketing plan, and then try to sell it to the audience? It just seems really backwards.
Well, you know, it does until you actually analyze it. And yeah. I would say that the VC industry is the same as the publishing industry, right? It's in a sense, it's the same as the movie industry.
Yeah.
And this is where a lot of entrepreneurs get messed up, right? Because let's say you get funding by a VC, you know, as it happens. So in my book, I tell the story. My first startup, I raised $3 million. 18 months later, we get an offer, acquisition offer for $100 million, which of course we took, right? In those days, $100 million was a lot. You'd be a fool not to take it. So after that, I joined Google and other success. I mean, I had a string of successes and I thought I was, you know, the Italian Steve Jobs, yeah. Stefano Jobini. And so with all that hubris, I decided, okay, now I want to do another startup. Forget raising $3 million. I'm going to raise a lot. So we raised $25 million. And I remember, you know, we raised the first round from Sequoia, the best VCs in Silicon Valley. And I thought, great. We have it made. if Sequoia thinks we're going to be successful, it's going to be successful. Right. But here's what happens, right? So the VCs and the publisher work in a very different way than the entrepreneurs and the authors. A VC gets to make many bets, and some of them will work and most of them will not work, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
Same with a publisher. They have a lot of eggs in the basket, and they know from past experience that some of the eggs will make up for the losses.
Right.
One Google for a Sequoia makes up pretty much for every single failure,
right,
or investment that did not succeed. And I'm not exaggerating here, right? But here's the problem. As the entrepreneur or as the author, you're at the other end. You only have one egg mm-hmm. and one basket,
yeah,
right? So when my VCs, who invested $25 million in my startup that did not work, so to them, it's a minor loss, right? It's a disappointment.
Right.
For me, it was 5 years of my life.
Yeah.
For my co-founder, 5 years of his life. For all of our employees and people that joined us, hoping to succeed, it was a lot of time and a lot of commitment. So VCs and publishers, they play a very different game. Their goal is to put out as many books as possible. They have a certain threshold for doing tests,
yeah,
but they can both afford to be less, less stringent with their testing. And in fact, they have to. Because if you're an entrepreneur, you go to a VC and said, here's my idea. And they said, okay, before we give you funding, I want this evidence and this evidence and this evidence.
Yeah.
Then they go to another VC and the VC says, sure, come on board. If it doesn't work, we invest in the team, we'll find something else. They're going to go with the second VC. So that's why if you're an entrepreneur, you're playing a very, very different game than if you are on the other side.
Well, it's fascinating because, the whole premise of this ebook that I wrote was the idea that, one of the sort of greatest insurance policies in a creative career is to be prolific, to write as much as possible, to create as much as possible, because then, even though you have, like you said, you have one basket, one egg, like that helps you create multiple baskets and multiple eggs in some way. I just noticed that pattern with a lot of creative people. So that's a really, I'd never thought about it that way.
Before you go, Shreen, no, because that's a very important point.
Yeah.
So you catch on fast, right? So that's what exactly, that's the whole point of my book and my tools and my methodology. Become your own VCs. How do VCs succeed? Because they invest mm-hmm. in a lot of ideas, right? Say
yeah.
10, 20, 30 ideas per year. Well, how do entrepreneurs succeed? You need to invest and test also a lot of ideas until you find one that works. But usually what happens, and I know because it happened to me, because it's human nature, you try to solve a problem, you come up with an idea, you fall in love with that idea, and instead of testing it in the real world, you apply confirmation bias. Love is blind.
Mm-hmm.
So, you assume that your idea works and you decide not to test it and you put all your passion on that one egg. Instead, I tell you, don't fall in love with the idea, right? Fall in love with the space that you want to address, with the problem that you want to solve. Fall in love with the problem, flirt with the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, interview and test many ideas and find out the ones that actually give you good feedback. So for your conference, right? You could have tried different titles and different locations and different price point and different focus,
yeah,
right? So, and that's what you really should do pretty much with everything that you do if you want to avoid failure.
Mm.
Having said that, and this is very important, sometimes, the world needs the crazy people. I give you a formula for not failing. So if you take money from VCs or you have investors, you don't want to fail, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad that there are the crazy people in the world that said, look, I know it makes no sense. I'm just going to go out and do it. I call it like the Promethean entrepreneurs,
yeah,
right? they're going to make it or die. And I love those people, right? And in fact, some of the things that I do are in that things. I don't know. I don't need the validation. Somebody in the world needs to do this, whether or not they can guarantee success. So I want to make sure that there is a balance,
mm-hmm.
right? So be very clear. If it's important to succeed because you have investors, because some people depend on it, your family depends on it,
yeah,
then follow my book, which will really flip around the odds from failure, right? Instead of a 10, 20% chance of success, I give you an 80 to 90% chance of success. But sometimes in your life, if you've been successful, take the risks, do something crazy. You know, otherwise, life gets a little bit too boring and predictable.
Yeah. So in this market success equation, you actually talk about failure being, failure due to launch, failure due to operations, and failure due to premise. Can you define what those are for us and expand on them?
Sure. So when I, the way to beat failure is to study failure and understand it. So when I started to work on prototyping these ideas, I decided, okay, let me look at a lot of companies that have failed. And I look at hundreds of companies in, dozens of industries and see if the techniques that I teach would have helped them out. So the first thing I did, I look at a lot of failures of both of companies and individual product. And I was able to put them into three buckets with the acronym FLOP. Failure due to launch, operation, or premise. Failure due to launch, usually, your marketing is not very good. The market doesn't know about your product. So that's that's clearly they're not going to buy it.
Yeah.
Failure due to operation means that your product doesn't work, right? So maybe it's a restaurant and the food is awful, or it's an app and it keeps crashing.
Yeah.
And it's a book and it's poorly edited, or it's a, yeah. The third one is P in FLOP, is failure due to premise.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that it doesn't matter how well you build the product, how well you market it, there's nothing that will save it. Nothing will make it a success. Your product is what I call the wrong it.
Right.
But, and the right it is a product that, if competently executed, will succeed in the market. The wrong it is a product that no amount of marketing fireworks or engineering excellence is going to make it succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And most failures, I'm sorry, that's the last point. 80 to 90% of the failures can be attributed to people building the wrong product. Not that they are incompetent in building or marketing, just they built a product that the market does not care about.
Yeah. Well, I think this is one of the things that I really appreciated that you said. And I remember, I think I tweeted this quote. You said, opinions about an idea are not data, not even close. Opinions are subjective, biased judgments. They're guesses thrown out without much thought, evidence, and critically with no skin in the game. If an idea spends too much time in what you call thought land, it gets wrapped in a fuzzy ball of unsubstantiated off-the-cuff judgments. And I think that you gave us, I think all four of the three ones. You mentioned confirmation bias earlier. I think that, that is one of them. But you talked about the skin in the game problem and the prediction problem. Can you tell us what those are as well?
Yeah. So the when you have an idea, so if I tell you my idea, I would say, hey, Srini, I have a new idea. Beer for dogs, you are single. Let's assume you have a dog, and you don't like to have pizza and beer alone. So I want to create pizza for dog and beer for dogs. They're completely healthy, right? They're not going to get drunk.
Yeah.
Now, when I tell it to you and you'll give me, Alberto, that's a stupid idea. My dog likes Alpo or whatever. So that's an opinion. Some other people may tell me, hey, Alberto, that's a great idea. I usually eat pizza alone and my dog is looking at me. Can I have a bite? And pizza is not healthy for dogs. So I said, look, these are all opinions, right? They're biased. You have a very hard time predicting whether it's a good idea or not. I mean, take Uber.
Yeah.
When somebody articulates Uber, when I first heard it, what is it? Strangers drive their own car and pick up strangers from strange places and drive them to some other strange places.
Yeah.
Right. It sounds like a setup for a horror movie.
Yeah.
Or a thriller, right. Or Airbnb.
Yeah.
Rent your couch for $50 a night, in the early days of couch surfing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you hear it, you have a lot of these biases that you think, it's not going, to work. So, you bring on your own, bias. There is also the translation problem, right? The way I envision an idea in my head is not the same way that you envision it when I explain it to you. So when you put all of these things together, you have a mess. Also, we're really bad at predicting, right? So let's get back to Uber.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard about Uber, I thought, over my dead body, right? I'm not going to get into a car with a random person. I mean, isn't that the first person your mother teaches you?
Yeah.
Trini, don't get into a car with a stranger, okay? Yell, stranger danger,
yeah,
as they say in the US. So, but that's the premise. So at first I thought, okay, this, I would never do it. Then I decided to try it and I thought, wow, this works great. I will use this instead of taxis at the airport, for example. So that was my prediction. What I didn't predict, it would actually change my behavior completely. I wouldn't use it just like taxis. I would use it in different ways. Another one, and then I told my daughter, hey, honey, you should try Uber. It's really fantastic. And she said, Dad, I've been using it for 2 years. After I told her, don't get into a car with strangers, right?
Yeah.
So not only that, but she also thought I will use it here and there. And then she lives in San Francisco where, you know, parking is next to impossible. So she pretty much brought her little Toyota to our house and left it in our driveway. And now she doesn't need the car anymore. Mm-hmm. So you see, it's so hard to predict whether we would use or not. Yeah. So Uber is a situation where I thought I would never use it. So I'll use it as a taxi. Well, I'll use it in a million ways. But we also suck at predicting things the other way. You know, when Webvan, the original home delivery, was announced, I thought, this is so fantastic. You know, I hate shopping for zucchini. You know, I'll just go online and buy zucchini the same way I buy books. So my prediction is I would never set foot in a grocery store. The reality is I tried it. It worked just exactly as advertised. For whatever reason, I didn't end up using it. So that's a prediction problem. We suck at predicting what would work for us.
So these are all sort of embedded cognitive biases. Are there ways to overcome them? I mean, I remember, you know, one of our former guests who also talked to another former guest about traditionally publishing a book said, oh, you know, that guy said his whole speaking career changed after a traditionally published book. It's been a game changer. And I thought, yeah, but he's also sold a million books. So there's confirmation bias at work. And that was the first thing I thought. And I know that I have it as well. So is there a way to avoid that? Like, is there a way to overcome any of these cognitive biases?
Yes. And, you know, of course, we could spend 10 hours on this discussion because I spent hundreds of hours studying it. But the shortcut is just collect data with skin in the game, right? So what we call biases is a combination, as I said, a fuzzy ball of opinion, judgment, you know, unsubstantiated beliefs, hopes, hypes. Replace hopes and hypes with hypotheses. And, you know, the beauty of a hypothesis exists for one reason, to be tested, right? When you say, hey, I have a hypothesis. If I do this, this thing will happen. Said, okay, great. You can go ahead and actually test that hypothesis without actually going all the way and building the product, right? So you don't even want to prototype it. You want to do something earlier than that because people spend months or years building prototypes. Mm-hmm. And you can test that much more quickly by building a prototype, which is a version of your product that doesn't exist, right? Your conference doesn't have to exist for you to announce the intention to have a conference, right. Correct?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. By the way, since you mentioned the conference, I want to confirm that you're doing the right thing. The first workshop for prototyping I did at Stanford, I thought, well, I would like to do a workshop at Stanford, you know, but you have to get a lot of permissions and everything. So what did I do? I created a brochure for the workshop that had me, a colleague, a Stanford professor, and, you know, and I had actually a date, you know, on June 5th, 2012, forget what it is, on the beautiful Stanford campus. And I sent it to all my LinkedIn contacts. So a lot of people replied, said, hey, Albert, I would love to attend this. So when I went and approached the people that gave me the permission to organize a conference, I went with them with data, right? Who said, look, you don't have to do this, but if we do this conference here, you're going to get people from these big shot companies, I don't know, Procter & Gamble, Anheuser-Busch, et cetera, et cetera. And so it started with the brochure. There was no conference. And then you said, okay, I told my colleague, hey, now we got to scramble because now we better put together a two-day workshop. Right? But we made sure that there was a demand and an interest because we knew that we could build it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's four criteria for the data that you actually outlined, which I thought were really funny, because I think the thing that I appreciated so much about this book is I'm an Indian person who sucks at math. Like everything math oriented just makes my head spin. That's why I do creative work. But you took this and you made it accessible to somebody like me. But you talk about four criteria: freshness, strong relevance, known provenance, and statistical significance. Can you define what those mean?
Yeah, and the problem that I'm trying to address is the following. I tell people first, look, do not depend on opinions, seek data. Now, most people think that if anything with numbers, right, you take random numbers, you put them in a spreadsheet, you sort them, and print a pretty chart, it looks like data, right?
Right.
Right. Or you can take data from other people and apply. So I said, no. There's two types of data that I describe in the book. The first one is OPD. It stands for other people's data. It's data collected by other people for other purposes for, you know, the project may be similar, but these are other people, other purposes, other times with other criteria. Instead, what you need is what I call YODA, which stands for your own data. So if you have, let's pick again, your conference, right? Yeah. So you can say, well, you know, conference, you know, business conferences are very successful. Last year, there were, you know, 43,000 of them in the United States. And on average, they made this much money. So that's what I call OPD, right? So it succeeds. So, you know, I'm going to do yet another conference. Instead, what you did is collect your own data, right? The specific data for the Srini specific conference. Yeah. So you want, and you want your data to be fresh. Freshness means that it has to be close to when the event happens. You cannot say, because things are moving so fast, right? If you go back, what was it? 5 years ago, you want to reach millennials. You say, well, Facebook is a place to reach millennials. Now, a lot of, you know, millennials, you know, do not use Facebook. They go to the latest, greatest. So it has to be fresh. It has to be relevant. It has to be specific to your project. And you ideally have to somebody to keep you honest, right? Because if you love your idea, if it's your idea, you're going to show some confirmation bias in looking at the data.
Yeah.
So, you know, pick your most critical friend, you know, the one that always says, you know, is a smart ass, plays to play the devil advocate. Hey, okay, Srini, you know, this data looks pretty good, but you did, you know, a lot of the people that sign up are not just your listener, yeah, they're your personal friends. So you really shouldn't count those and, you know, and extrapolate from that.
It's funny. This is the most ridiculous story, and I can't believe I'm going to share it with you on the air, but I thought it was kind of relevant. So a couple of days ago, I came across a profile of this girl on this Coffee Meets Bagel app, and I was like, wow, she's really cute. And then she never showed up again. And I had just talked to this professional poker player, Alex Sorelli, about, you know, building a tolerance for risk. And I was like, okay, wait a minute. Based on his advice, if I Googled this girl and sent her an email, there's a 50-50 chance this could work out in my favor. And if it doesn't, I'm kind of in the same position I'm in right now. And so I was like, okay, at the risk of appearing like a total lunatic, I figured, what the hell?
And?
I don't know. I'll tell you. I haven't checked my email. This morning.
You cannot tell me a story like this and not tell me how it ends.
I don't know the ending yet, so I can't tell you. But it came to mind as we were talking about that. You know, sort of combining your ideas and, you know, sort of this idea of risk tolerance. So I thought, yeah, okay, you know, like, I'm not in any worse a situation, you know, than I was before.
That's absolutely, they're just little bets. And by the way, it's so funny because in my book, I actually talk about, you know, fear of rejection that is built in us, you know, and we try to go and ask for dates. What people are afraid of, the reason they don't do this kind of market research that I talk about is because they have a fear of being rejected, not by the girl or by the boy, but by the market, right? So as long as your idea exists only in your head, you know, can be the most beautiful, successful idea. But once you go out in the world and you run the test, you run this risk of learning that, oh, I thought everybody wanted beer for dog or pizza for dog. And, you know, I spent $1,000 in Google ads and I didn't get a single click.
Yeah.
So that is market rejection, you know, and in our guts, it feels a lot like all other kinds of rejection, right? You know, romantic rejections, you know, work rejections, and so on and so forth. Mm.
Well, let's do this. I want to come full circle back to sort of, you know, you've mentioned that you've sold multiple startups, you know, $100 million offer. You were early on at Google. And so this, you know, anytime I've had the good fortune to talk to somebody in your position, I always want to ask them about sort of money, you know, like what was your narrative about money going in and growing up? And, you know, what is your narrative about it now? And is it, everybody says, yes, this will solve your money problems, but it won't solve any of your other problems. You probably heard it. Naval did an entire podcast about how to get rich, and it was brilliant. I mean, it was one of the best pieces of content I've heard all year long. And, you know, I think that there are those of us who are like, one of my friends who works on my team is like, you know what? He's like, that's great. People tell you money won't buy you happiness. He's like, I'd rather be poor and unhappy, or, you know, rich and unhappy is what he jokes. But so I wonder, you know, one, how much of this, like being a Larry and Sergey, like how much of that is, okay, you know what, this is just destiny? Because we've had Justine Musk here too, Elon's ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she said is that, you know, she didn't want to get deterministic, but there are some people who are just going to achieve at that level. And I think that as a culture, you know, you basically go through Medium every day and you're like, oh, if I'm not Steve Jobs, Oprah, or Mark Zuckerberg, well, then something is wrong with me.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I don't know if who's ever at that level, but I'm definitely not there now. So I believe that one's relationship to money changes as it should change over time, mm-hmm. right? So when you're young, I guess it's okay to be ambitious. The best thing about having made some money is to be able to verify for yourself that it's not enough, right? It doesn't buy you happiness. Yeah. The best thing about having, achieved a certain degree of success is that you don't have to go and look back and say, well, I've never, I haven't proven myself. There are just steps that once you reach them, you realize firsthand that what they've been telling you all along, right? Yeah. Money doesn't buy happiness. Success cannot be defined in terms of the external. You realize that all those things are true because you've been there yourself. But now I will tell you, for people like us, like the doubting Thomases, we kind of have to experience it ourselves. Yeah. So the best gift of actually having made some money is to realize that, yes, dang, they were right. Right. Now I'm going to go and focus on completely different things, right? Because what you need to be happy is very, very little, and you don't want to sacrifice happiness to achieve the kind of level of financial success that frankly only happens by chance, yeah. in my opinion. You have hard work, but if circumstances were different, Larry and Sergey would be very successful professors mm-hmm. of computer science, right? Yeah. At some prestigious university, equally happened, but they were at the right place at the right time. So
Well, yeah, it's funny because I remember the Bill Gross TED talk when he said he analyzed something like 300 startups, and he said one of the biggest factors was timing. And, Friendster came out before Facebook, but it didn't have the same level of success. Like we always joke, my friends and I went to Berkeley. We graduated December 2000 and we were college from 96 to 2000. It was like watching the most amazing party from, across the bay. And then when we got to San Francisco, it was over.
That's right. that's absolutely right. Yes. So right now, who am I fan of money wise? The people that just have the courage to give it all away, mm-hmm. right? My favorite story is the philosopher Wittgenstein. He was heir to an enormous fortune, right, from his family, and he just decided I don't want it. So he gave it all to his sister, and of course I wasn't there. But the story is. From one of his biographies that, well, why did you give all your money away to your sister? Why didn't you give it to other people? And he said, because, money can really corrupt, and my sister has already a lot of money, so I'm not going to do her any damage. Mm.
That's funny.
That's my attitude. The best way of making some money is that you realize, okay, this is good. This is enough. You don't need a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, I think the Paul Graham one is How to Start a Startup class, which, Sam Altman's class, Paul Graham gives one of the talks and he said, you think that people like Larry and Sergey live these charmed lives, but he's like, what you got to remember is Larry Page started running 100 miles an hour when he was 26 years old and he's never stopped. And, basically he's like, your quality of your problems change. But he said, and of course he said, nobody has any sympathy for you when you're a billionaire. There's a really funny way of phrasing it.
Yeah, imagine when was it Zuckerberg testifying at the congressional hearing? Yeah. that cannot be fun.
No. And at the same time, I don't think anybody's like, "Oh, poor Zuckerberg."
Yeah, that's right. If you're at that level, you're probably getting one lawsuit per day for this reason or for that reason. So you're just like, what is it, the saying? More money, more problems. there is an amount that is just right, just good enough. Once you can provide for your family, send your kids to school, be able to put food on the table, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I think the rest is an excess. But doing that in Silicon Valley and accepting it is very, very hard. I think our screwed up relationship with the money at all level is because of so many. Trouble, much dissatisfaction in the world.
Yeah, I think that not only is it a dissatisfaction, it seems that it's also led to a sort of ruthless approach to business. I mean, Simon Sinek has talked about this a lot in his latest book, The Infinite Game, and another one called Leaders Eat Last, where I mean, it seems like part of what happened is, you know, growth for its own sake just became this thing that everybody was so focused on. One of my friends, Paul Jarvis, who was also a guest here, said that, you know, in any other field or any other part of life, infinite growth is called cancer.
That's right. That's right. It's unsustainable. You know, need to keep adding. Look, if you want the GDP to grow, how can you do it? You add more people, and God knows the planet doesn't need more people, right? Or you get people to spend more money, but people are already spending beyond their means. So where does this growth come from? So I think, but this goes into very, very philosophical territory.
Absolutely.
But as I put at the end of my book, right? So it's important that if you decide to bring a new product to the market, that it's the right it, meaning a product that will succeed if you build it well. But also it's important to make sure that it's the right it product for you. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I have this guy, no kids. His idea was a startup that had to do with diaper delivery. And I told him, why do you want to do this? He said, well, because I see a market need, a market and opportunity. And I told him, do you really want to be in the diaper business? I mean, if this succeeds, this really excites you. So people sometimes want to do something just for the money, but they have no interest in that. So make sure it's the right it, a product that will succeed. Yeah. Make sure it's the right it for you, that it's, you know, it comes natural, and also ideally for the world, right? So if you want to make money, you know, come up with a new version of a crack or ecstasy, you know, there are many ways of making money in immoral ways. Yeah. But if you can have the trifecta, you are building a right product, you know, product that the market wants, about something you're passionate and interested in, and the product is good, you know, it kind of contributes to a general goodness of the world. Then you have the trifecta, and I think that will lead to a much more satisfying life in general. Wow. And that's what I hope my book inspires people to achieve.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really just beautiful place to finish our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, and since I listened to your podcast, I hate to give you the same answer that other people have given you, but, you know, I'm not going to make up something just to be different, right? Right. And I think it has to do with, you know, being true to yourself, being genuine. Don't do things just to impress other people for some external purposes, right? So if you're passionate about music, but you know that musicians don't make as much money as lawyers, you know, for Pete's sake, don't become a lawyer, yeah. Right?
Wow.
In fact, I have three friends that are lawyers, and now they kind of retired, and they're trying to be full-time musicians. I think, dang, you know, I lost 30 years of practice. Now it's a pretty harsh slog. So yeah. I think to be unmistakable, you have to be really genuine. Otherwise, you're not going to be mistaken, but you're going to be mistaken for a fake. You're going to be fake. So that's no fun, and it's hard to sustain.
Amazing. Where can people find out more about you, your book, your work, everything that you're up to?
Yeah, albertosavoia.com. It's just like Albert Einstein, except that I have an O at the end. And the book is called The Right It. All available in the finest bookstores, and I'm pretty accessible. You know, if people have some questions, they can send me email, and I try to help them. Again, my mission these days is to help our most valuable resource, entrepreneurs and innovators, to make sure that the idea that they pursue and invest in will succeed, because they really are our most valuable resource. So that's my passion these days.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better?
Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The Four Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.